When we read the Bible, we read some of the miracles as stories, but tend to neglect the human emotions involved, as well as the lessons being taught, because the lessons that are being taught may be very relevant to us, and we may have the same feelings. Today, we're going to take a look at some of the healing miracles described in Luke 8 and then later in Luke 13. So if you want, you can turn to Luke 8. We will be there for a large part of this split sermon. They're also mentioned in Matthew and Mark, but I'm limiting it to Luke because those are in more detail. We're also going to take a look at one example when an individual was not healed. But as I mentioned, we tend to read this as a story as opposed to a lesson or feeling the emotions of when we were there, or if we were there. So let's take a look at Luke 8, beginning in verse 40. And this is when Jesus was returning by boat. Now, imagine if you were alive at that time, or even now for that matter, and Jesus was returning by boat. Would you go to watch him, to see him in the flesh? Are you pretty sure you would? So would I. And here's this throng of people that you are part of waiting to see Jesus Christ come off the boat with his disciples with him. It'd be very exciting. So beginning in Luke 8, verse 40, and put yourself there now. So it was when Jesus returned that the multitude welcomed him. All right, so we already know, just as if we knew Jesus was coming on a boat, we would all be there. Well, these people were the same. Jesus is coming on a boat. We want to see him. For they were all waiting for him. He's already pretty famous at this point. So while he's coming off the boat and the disciples are trying to push some people away so that he could get through, all of a sudden, something happened. Verse 41. And behold, there came a man named Jairus. And he was the ruler of the synagogue, and he fell down at Jesus' feet and begged him to come to his house. For he had an only daughter about 12 years of age, and she was dying. But as he went, the multitudes thronged him. So here's the scene. You're in this crowd. Jesus' disciples are trying to make a way for Jesus to move. And then all of a sudden, Jairus, with people also moving the crowd, trying to get to Jesus. Got a lot of confusion here, but what's significant, and really significant, Jairus was an important man. The ruler of the synagogue is a rich and powerful individual. And then he falls down at Jesus' feet, and he's begging him to come to his house. Well, normally people who are rich and powerful do not beg. But Jairus was begging. So this is something very unique about him. And if you were standing there, you would be surprised by all this. Now, what's also significant is that many synagogue rulers, as Jairus, had close ties to the Pharisees and may very well have been a Pharisee, and Jesus was not very popular with the Pharisees. So to have one who's close to a Pharisee or a Pharisee beg Jesus, as rich and powerful as that individual was, to beg Jesus, that would make a big impression on you. Obviously, he loved his daughter a great deal. Now, he had probably tried local physicians. It didn't work. His daughter was near death, but he was desperate. because he knew his daughter was near death, and he had to get Jesus to his daughter. But there's this crowd slowing everything down, and he wants to get him to move. So as you watch all this, this is very strange. And then something very unique happens. As we get to verse 43 of Luke 8. Now a woman having a flow of blood for 12 years, who had spent all her livelihood on physicians and could not be healed by any, came from behind and touched the border of his garment. And immediately her flow of blood stopped. And Jesus said, "Who touched me?" When all denied it, Peter and those with him said, "Master, the multitude throng and press you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" Now, we've all probably have been in a crowd where there's one person wiggling through somehow or other. And this is the woman wiggling through, pushing you out of the way so she could get closer to Jesus. Now, she did this because she was absolutely desperate. I mean, 12 years is a long time to suffer. We can concede that. We also realize that she started getting ill when Jesus was barely a teenager. So she's been sick a long time. But unlike Jairus, who was wealthy, she was poor. And Jairus was powerful. She was powerless. So they are absolute contrasts to each other. She was apparently afraid of approaching Jesus face to face, so she snuck up behind. And she was good at wiggling through crowds. Actually, my wife was really good at that too, and she was little. But she had faith that if she could touch his garment, she would be healed, and she was healed. Also, there's a double miracle here. Her flow of blood made her unclean by Jewish standards. When an unclean person touches a clean person, the clean person becomes unclean. And if you're standing in that crowd and you're somewhere near Jesus so that you can see, she became clean. And he didn't become unclean. That is another miracle. So not only was she healed, but the unclean were also made clean. Well, Jesus is aware of what's happening here. So he said in verse 46, but Jesus said, "Somebody touch me, for I perceived power going out of me." Now, when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him. She declared to him in the presence of all the people the reason she had touched him and how she was healed immediately. And he said to her, "Daughter, be of good cheer." Important point here. "Your faith has made you well. Go in peace." So she is showing very strong faith at this point, as well as being humble, because she was afraid to come face to face with Jesus. So here she was, clean where she had been unclean. She had suffered for 12 years, and now she was healed. We might wonder in a moment, well, why 12 years? Why not 6 years or 2 years or 1 year? But for some reason, it was 12 years. Now, the Jewish crowd, you're in that Jewish crowd, would mentally be amazed that this has happened. But if we look at Jairus at this point, he's not so happy about it. He's time limited. His daughter is dying. We have a lot of parents here. If you're a parent and your child is dying, and there's a chance that if this individual can get there, your child will live, you are not patient. You want Jesus there, like, now, yesterday, an hour ago, wherever. So he is in panic mode. The crowd is amazed, and she is healed. But a major point is her faith required action. She may have had the faith. She could have stayed home and had the faith that Jesus would have healed her, but it required the action of actually going there and doing it. She had to seek Jesus. She had to break through the crowd, and she had to teach and touch Jesus' garment for the healing to take place. Now, Jairus knew that if Jesus touched his daughter, that she would be healed. And he knew how sick his daughter was. And he would be very exasperated at this point, and everything is slowed down. And then something dramatic happens. Because you see, as Jairus' people are opening up the crowd, a person arrives from verse 49. While he, Jesus, was still speaking, someone came from the ruler of the synagogue's house saying to him, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher." At this point, if you were looking at Jairus' face, he must have been in tears. The daughter that he loved is dead. The delay of this woman and this crowd may have been too much to get Jesus to his house in time. At this point, he felt hopeless and helpless. Are there times in your life where you felt helpless and hopeless? Jesus realized that, and he encourages him and his faith, because this was a real test of Jairus' faith, because now it was beyond healing. First, we needed a resurrection from the dead. Second, we needed a healing. And third, we needed uncleanness made clean, because dead bodies are unclean. But Jesus encourages him. But when Jesus heard it, he answered him, saying, "Do not be afraid, only believe, and she will be made well." Oh, he's encouraging her. Same thing with us when we are helpless and hopeless. Jesus will give us encouragement, maybe not exactly what we wanted, but he will open a door for some encouragement if we have faith and the humility to go through it. When he, Jesus, came into the house, I'm on verse 51, he permitted no one to go in except Peter, James, and John. So Jesus didn't want to make this a show. He wanted to make this private. And the father and the mother of the girl. That's important. Family is important to God. He left out disciples so he could bring the family. Now all wept and mourned for her. So this is an important person. So there are people there at the house. They were probably praying for the girl. They were trying to support Jairus' wife and Jairus when he was there. And they know she's dead. And Jesus says, "Do not weep. She is not dead, but sleeping." And they ridiculed him, knowing that she was dead. So they had no faith in Jesus' ability at this point. But he put them all outside, except for those that he had selected, took her by the hand and called, saying, "Little girl, arise." Then her spirit returned, and she arose immediately. And he commanded that she be given something to eat. And her parents were astonished, which is probably an understatement. Because if you have a dead child, and Jesus walks in, and suddenly you have a live, healthy child, you'll be more than astonished at that point. But he charged them to tell no one what had happened. Now, the people who ridiculed Jesus must have been totally dumbfounded. They were just totally blindsided because this dead girl walks out. And they were also amazed that she was clean and Jesus was clean, and touching a dead body makes you unclean. So we got three miracles: resurrection, healing, and becoming clean. The interesting part, and this is the part that I don't understand, and if you have more insight, certainly let me know. Why did he say, "Don't tell anyone"? This is an important person. There's a multitude there who knows that this kid is dead, and now she's alive. Plus, there's a multitude that came from where he got off the boat. So you may have hundreds of people who have seen this miracle as well as the other miracle, and you how is that not going to be spread around? I mean, talk about gossip spreads. I mean, this is the real thing, and this would really spread. So I really don't understand that. Commentaries say, I tried to look this up. Commentaries said that it was to limit the number of people following him. But this miracle was too big and too significant, and there were too many eyewitnesses to really cover it up. So I really don't have an understanding on that part. But I want to take a look at another miracle. And this is in Luke 13, so we're still in Luke. You don't have to turn the pages too much here. Luke 13. And this is the miracle of the bent over woman. All right, let's put ourselves in this perspective. Imagine you get your email Friday night from Mr. Bradford saying, we're going to have a special speaker at services tomorrow. And the special speaker will be Jesus Christ himself with his spirit body coming. Guess what? We'd have a lot of people here. And in fact, the front row would probably be filled. Imagine that. No, I know you can't imagine that, but just imagine that. That's what would happen. Well, Luke 13:10 brings us into that scenario. Jesus is coming to their synagogue, so you can bet a lot of people are going to be there. Reading from Luke 13, verse 10. Now he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath, and behold, there was a woman who had a spirit of infirmity 18 years. So Jesus was a kid when she first got this spirit of infirmity and was bent over and could in no way raise herself. That makes her unclean by Old Testament Jewish standards. Now, she did not come forward to ask Jesus to heal her. Continuing in verse 12. But when Jesus saw her, he called her to him and said to her, woman, you are loosed from your infirmity. And he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God. Now she's been suffering for 18 years. Unlike the other woman and unlike Jairus, she did not ask Jesus to be healed. He called her to him and he healed her. Now we know she was a faithful member because she was attending synagogue. And as someone who was bent over like that and considered unclean, she'd probably be in a corner, was living with family because no one really wanted to touch her. She had it hard. She suffered those 18 years. That's a long time. That's a lot older than some of the people here. I'm sure she prayed for the healing, otherwise she wouldn't be going to the synagogue, so she certainly had faith. Her condition was painful and it was debilitating. But God chose this particular moment in time to step in and change everything. Why after 18 years for this woman? Why after 12 years for the other woman? Maybe did it have to be that long? And the 12-year-old girl was a very short time. We don't really know, and I think one reason we don't know is because we are each like jigsaw puzzle pieces in the coming kingdom of God. And what we go through and what we learn makes our piece fit. And we'll learn about that in the future. But now I want to drop back to Psalm 103.3, because this has come up previously. You can turn there. You're probably familiar with it. It's a common verse. It's talking about God who forgives all your iniquities. Yep, we know God forgives sins. Who heals all your diseases. So does that mean that every disease we have will be healed? Well, if that was the case, unless you had an accident, you would live forever, like the elves in Lord of the Rings. because you'd keep being healed. So I had a condition this year with my heart. I wasn't healed. God took care of it in another way. But it says, heal all diseases. Could there be more meaning to it? And I think if we take a look, going back to Luke 4:18, Jesus is saying, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted. So there's an extra dimension to healing. Yes, he can heal our diseases. And I've been anointed and taken into surgery, and then they checked and said, well, you don't need surgery. And they took me out of surgery, and I never had it. I was healed. Mr. Fay had anointed me. At times I was anointed and I wasn't healed. But to heal the brokenhearted adds an extra dimension to the concept of healing. At the end of his life, Jesus would say to the Father, and I'm reading from John 17, verse 4, I have glorified you on the earth. I have finished the work which you have given me to do. I finished what I came to do. Does that mean there were no more sick people on the earth? He healed them all? No, there were plenty of sick people. Were there more sermons to be preached that he could reach more people? Sure. There were more people he could have preached to and reached. Were there more disciples to train? Absolutely. He lost one disciple. Judas abandoned him. He had to pick someone else who was trained. Does it mean that every person he cared for had heard his message and responded? No. Were there no more unchecked boxes on Jesus' to-do list? But Jesus was crystal clear about why he came, and he was certain he had completed his task. So what was his task? I have finished the work which you have given me to do. I have finished what I came to do. His sacrifice allowed the Holy Spirit to be given, and allowed us to become converted, to become first fruits. That's the work he was given to do. But let's take a look at a biblical example of someone who was not being healed. And the fourth example we'll have today is the Apostle Paul. Now we have to concede that Paul was a highly successful apostle. And he was designated the apostle to the Gentiles. So there were 12 apostles to Israel and one apostle to the Gentile. To show how successful he was, if you did some secular searching, you would find that there were churches through the entire Asian steppe, all the way up to Beijing. There was even a bishop of Beijing. So what he taught to the Gentiles was incredibly successful. Those Christians were essentially eliminated when the Muslims came, and they were called Nestorian Christians, and that's just history. I actually read an interesting book on that, on the history of the what would then be the Nestorian or Orthodox Church. But Paul had a very difficult time in his travels. In his own words, reading from 2 Corinthians 11:25, you don't have to turn there, 3 times I was beaten with rods, once I was stoned, 3 times I was shipwrecked, a day and a night I have been in the deep. Now, when you're beaten with rods and whipped like he was, you are not in good shape afterward. You have scars. Roman whips weren't just even whips. They had stones, other items tied into them, bones tied into them. So you were pretty badly cut up. He went through that 3 times. And they didn't care what, it wasn't just on your back, it was also on your face. So at that point, Paul was not very pretty. When it came to stonings, stonings were not like playing dodgeball. Someone throws a stone, 10 guys throw a stone at you and you can throw one back. It doesn't work that way. They throw you off the roof. And as soon as you land, which if you're still at all even conscious when you land and you haven't broken any bones, they start throwing down from the roof stones on top of you. So these will break your bones, and when they hit your head, will give you a concussion. If they hit you in the eye, they'll blind you in the eye. You'll certainly have dizziness. And they keep throwing stones until you're completely covered by stones, so more stones won't do any good. And usually you're dead. And Paul may very well have been dead, and he had to be resurrected just so his apostles could, others can pull him out. So he's in bad shape. So considering these beatings and stonings, he must have been scarred. He probably had dizziness. He certainly had vision issues, as we get from Galatians 4:13. You know that because of physical infirmity, I preached the gospel to you at first. What then was the blessing you enjoyed? For I bear you witness that if possible, you would have plucked out your own eyes and given them to me. So he may very well have been at least partially blinded. And he might very well have been dizzy from the stones that hit his head, which is concussions, and he had no helmet protection. Well, naturally, Paul asked to be healed, and he's got a good case for being healed. One, he was doing God's work. Two, it wasn't pleasant. He was kicked out of towns. He was threatened, as well as all the beatings and stoning. He had a lot of faith. He did the job regardless. So he had a pretty good case for requesting to be healed. We read in 2 Corinthians 12, verse 7, and this is also a verse that you would be familiar with. And lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelation, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me. So I exalted above measure. Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it might depart from me. So he asked for healing three times. And he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Paul was not healed. If anyone had a strong case for being healed, it's the Apostle Paul. He had faith in God's plan. He was delivering on God's plan. But God determined it was better that he appear weak, and he could use a physically weak individual to accomplish so much. So we can summarize here. We now have a comparison of four people who requested to be healed. We have a woman, 12 years suffering, Jairus, whose daughter had died, and we have a woman who had suffered for 18 years, even though she didn't request healing, but she was healed. All had faith in Jesus' ability to heal, and all were humble, and all were healed. We contrast that with the Apostle Paul, who was not healed. He also had faith. He also was humble. He was doing God's will. He was spreading the church to the Gentiles. He had suffered much physical trauma in all of this. He may even have been resurrected after the stoning, but he wasn't healed. Paul seems to have the best case to be healed. While Jairus' daughter and the unnamed women who were healed did not have as strong a case, if you will, if you were looking at cases. But as we read before, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. I mean, no one doubts Paul's faith. That's a given. Paul had great faith. Just to keep going. Imagine if you had to keep going, you were chased out of a town, and then you were in another town, you were preaching the gospel, and you were whipped and hit with rods, and then you were stoned, and now you're going to another town. Well, what's next? Then you're shipwrecked. Is it kind of rough? You would kind of expect to be healed at that point, but she wasn't, because God was proving a point. Paul's piece in the puzzle did not require healing. God had a plan for what Paul must go through, and it didn't include healing. God also had a plan for Jairus and his daughter, as well as those two women, and it did require healing. What about us? We do not know God's plan for us. In my life, sometimes I was healed, and sometimes it was a trial I had to go through. We don't know how we fit into God's plan. Are we going through a health trial? Maybe to understand it better and help people in the second resurrection that have the same problem to go through that trial? Is it an issue that we need to go through? Is it to build our faith no matter what the outcome? We do know Paul did not lose faith and accepted not being healed and kept doing God's work while God used him to heal other people. So here he was, God using him to heal other people, and he himself was not healed. That's a challenging faith issue. Imagine that. But it's an example for us. If Paul did not lose faith when he was not healed, then we don't lose faith either, because God was still working through Paul, and God can still be working through you. My strength is made perfect in weakness. One area of hope for us is, even if we lack faith, we can ask for it. In Mark 9, verse 24, immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, "Lord, I believe, help my unbelief." And the demon was cast out from the child. Sometimes we may lack faith, and if that's the case, we can ask for that faith and strength to go through the trial. Where does that leave us when we need to be healed? We need faith. We can ask for more. We've learned that it doesn't matter if you're rich and important or not. You must be humble. That's first key. You must have faith. You must be humble. The unknown part is, how does this fit into God's plan for each of our lives? If God's plan includes healing, it's a done deal. If it's a trial that we must go through, he will provide that open door to get through it, as he did for Paul. As injured as Paul was, Paul completed his job. The lesson for us is to approach God in humility and faith, and if we lack faith, to ask for it. If we are healed, that's part of God's plan, we must thank God for it. If not, we ask God to provide an open door and strength to go through that door.